Oh. No. That's what happened. Going to introduce everybody first, but I'll wait to do Brynn since she's not here.
But I would acknowledge that one of our speakers has so that people know that, you know, that it's on, you know, out of her.
That's mine.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually.
What I started doing, either with a Sharpie or I started reading up. At least I'm forgetful. I don't know. Maybe other people are not. The bongo means,
Well, I've done it a couple different ways, but the Sharpies seem to wear off. But this, I just put. And then put my cell phone on.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Because I do Sharpie, but that one.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. Yeah, one of those. All right. Okay.
Very good.
Good morning. Let's go ahead and get started. Good morning and welcome. My name is Leticia Cáceres and I'm the moderator for this morning's session. I would repeat the session name, but it's really long. I'll be presenting shortly, so I'll save my introduction for that time. We are missing one colleague. She'll be with us shortly. But before we get started, I'd like to get an idea of who we have out here. How many of you are from outside of California? Great. How many of you are working or have worked in the HIV field? Okay, good. And how many of you have a good understanding of border issues already? Okay. So that'll help us, I think, direct our presentation more specifically. Well, I've had the privilege and the honor of working closely with each of these women on the panel. while working as the HIV operations manager at San Ysidro Health Center's GASA, and a program, an HIV/AIDS program there, which is located about 15 miles south of here along the border. You'll hear more about that program in a bit. Each of these extraordinary women has made and continues to make a significant contribution to the growing body of knowledge on the unique and complex barriers to care of the Latino transborder population. Defined as those who work and or live on both sides of the border, the transborder population faces a very different experience than Latinos living anywhere else. The groundbreaking work of these individuals has led to a better understanding of this experience and the factors affecting access to care. Today you'll learn more about the key barriers to care, in particular the role and impact of HIV stigma in accessing HIV prevention, care, and treatment services. You will also learn the strategies and service models that have been developed to address them and the impact they have had on the community. For those of you who do not have access to the online presentations, I believe you have to pay about $40 or something like that. I'm sure my colleagues and I would be happy to send those to you. Just come up to us after. So without further ado, I want to introduce the panel for this session. First, we have Dr. Maria Luisa Zuniga. She's an assistant professor and epidemiologist in the Division of International Health and Cross-Cultural Medicine in the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. She holds a secondary appointment in the UCSD Division of Community Pediatrics and serves as core faculty for the UCSD San Diego State University Joint Doctoral Programs in Global Health and Health Behavior. She specializes in behavioral health and access to care in Latino populations living with HIV, as well as access to care in the U.S. border Mexico border region. Dr. Zuniga applies principles of community-based participatory research in her work to collaborate with community-based agencies and clinics in the development of research studies that are meaningful and culturally relevant to the communities she serves. Specific areas of health research in which she focuses includes HIV/AIDS, HIV-related stigma, and HIV-transmitting risk behaviors, including HIV prevention in high-risk youth, access to health care for persons who migrate between Latin America and the United States, and health issues relevant to persons living in the U.S.-Mexico border region, including binational health care access and utilization. Currently, Dr. Zuniga is conducting a study to improve understanding of barriers to participation in clinical trials for Latino populations with HIV and AIDS. Next, we have Rosana Scolari. Ms. Scolari is the Director of Program Integration for San Ysidro Health Center, a community health center located in San Diego, California. In her previous role as San Ysidro Health Center's Director of HIV Services, a position she held for over 10 years, Ms. Scolari developed and administered the only HIV/AIDS primary care and social service programs specifically designed to meet the unique needs of Latinos residing in the border region of San Diego County. Ms. Scolari was responsible for the successful implementation of over 19 grant-funded HIV/AIDS programs, including the coordination of San Ysidro Health Center's HRSA-funded HIV primary care and social support services, as well as several local and state-funded prevention programs. Ms. Scolari grew up in the community of San Ysidro, less than 3 blocks from the center and less than 1 mile south of the border, considered the busiest border crossing in the world. As a child and teenager, crossing the border for Ms. Scolari was a daily experience. She lived in San Ysidro but attended school in Tijuana, Mexico. In 1996, she graduated from UC Berkeley, where she received a degree in sociology. Her binational, bicultural, and bilingual upbringing provided the knowledge, experience, and insight necessary to develop culturally and linguistically appropriate programs that serve the needs of San Ysidro's predominantly Latino patient population. So I think we'll go ahead and get started with the first presentation by Dr. Zuniga and Rosana.
Thank you very much, Leticia. And I'd like to, preface the presentation with a little bit of information as well on our role and what we're bringing to it, because the focus is on promotoras, and part of what Rosana and I would like to bring to you is the context in which these programs work. And the area that is so difficult for us to navigate when we're trying to bring persons in to care and facilitate access to care and utilization of services, even when the services are available. And so this is why we're setting the stage a little bit with the border and with stigma. And Rosanna and I have been presenting together for about 8 years now, and I have the privilege of continued work with her. And this is also an example of a community and academic partnership. And the work we do together is called community-based participatory research. So I know there are other sessions that talk about this. I just would like to let you know that this is truly the work that we do, and that the research would not be informed so well or be so meaningful without the participation of our community partners, meaningful participation at all levels. So we have nothing to disclose, no relationships. And I'd like to thank our co-authors and collaborators, Leticia Cáceres, Jesse Brennan, Dr. Stephanie Strathdy, Estela Blanco, who's with us today as well. And this work was supported by funding from the Health Resources and Services Administration and National Institutes of Mental Health. Again, National Institutes of Mental Health, and as well the participants who have given their time and their insights and their trust to give us their information, and our sponsoring agencies. So the Southern California Border HIV/AIDS Project, on which so much of the knowledge that we'll be presenting today has been built, was funded by HRSA. And it was a multi-site evaluation agency. We have colleagues that are from Arizona that also participated in the multi-site initiative. The funding period was from 2000 to 2006. The data that we'll be presenting was collected from 2001 to 2004. San Ysidro Health Center was our lead agency, and the five SPINS border sites in California, and throughout the border region, included California, Arizona, El Rio Health Center, where our colleague is with us today, New Mexico, and Texas. And our local evaluation was from the University of California, San Diego. Our local partners, who are very important and continue to be important with the community clinic system, are Family Health Centers of San Diego, Vista Community Clinic, who reaches migrant populations as well, Clínicas de Salud del Pueblo, and Comprehensive Health Centers. And the reason I take some time to honor these agencies is that none of the work that you'll be seeing would have been possible without them. This is the border. And the border is different from, depending on the perspective, the region in which one lives. This happens to be the San Diego-Tijuana border. And you can see some of the density of population on that. Where this view is from the south side looking north. And one of the things that I think embodies our work is to understand that to live in the borders, to live at the center, to be at the entrance and the exit, to inhabit two worlds, two cultures, and to accept both. And that helps us understand a little bit of the sometimes dual nature that we're looking at, not just health disparities, but health opportunities. So these are some of the things that also help inform our work. And the U.S.-Mexico border context. So I'd given some indication of, I'm not sure if there's a pointer. We're located here in the most southwestern corner of the United States, and you'll see it's a 2,000-mile border approximately. The border, again, is defined in many different ways. You'll see in different studies where it's defined as 62 miles north and south of geographical border. But in other places, you'll see reference to border states. So you can even include a whole population in the state of California or Baja California. The Tijuana-San Diego border is one of the busiest land border crossings in the Western Hemisphere. And about 46 million northbound crossings were documented in 2002. And these are persons that are crossing on a daily basis for work, for economic reasons, for to see family. So it's a very, very busy area. And one of the things we're seeing also is a decrease in the number of people crossing for a variety of reasons. Our populations, you can see that there's about 3 million in San Diego County, and projected growth to almost 4 million by 2030. So we have a lot. And the population of Tijuana is also growing. I'd like to ask Rosana to provide a little bit more if she has any insights on this.
I just wanted to add some more border information, given that this was a project that encompassed the whole 2 mile border region. As you heard, I grew up here in San Diego, San Ysidro specifically, and considered myself, of being like the quote said, in the center, and it really affected my identity growing up. I didn't know what part of me was here and what part of me was from over there, and I constantly moved between two worlds, and growing up that way, I realized now the benefit of that and take advantage of that, but it was a confusing time, it was a challenging time. But it's two very different worlds, and how and to maneuver in both is quite a skill that I've been able to improve and get benefits out of. I thought I knew a lot about the border growing up here and having that experience. And once I got involved in this project back in 2000 and had an opportunity to visit the other borders, it just opened my eyes to a reality that they are so unique. Every single area is very unique. And just going east a little bit to Imperial County, you see the tremendous difference between the San Ysidro border and the border in El Centro and Mexicali. And again, here I was thinking I knew a lot about the border, but as soon as you take me outside of this region, it just becomes different challenges. I mean, the same basic concept of living in between two worlds, but the two worlds constantly are changing along the 2 mile area. So it's an experience. Being part of this project was a very, very interesting experience. And I encourage you, if you're interested in the border regions, to see the differences, to try to take advantage of any opportunity that you have to visit the borders, the different cities in the borders. And you can actually feel the difference. I think that was my comment on the previous one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So a little bit of information on the epidemiology of HIV in our region. One of the areas that is of tremendous impact in our border region is understanding the dynamics of the HIV epidemic and the flow and ebb as well of the infection and exposure and risk behaviors. So Mexico is centered in an area that is surrounded by higher prevalence countries. And in the border region in particular, you'll see that we are seeing an increase in the number of HIV and AIDS cases. And it's starting to match that of San Diego. And when you look specifically at Latinos in San Diego, you are starting to see the PAR getting towards that 1%. And that's where our work is so important, to work binationally and to understand the dynamics of populations between the two countries. The incidence among HIV positive groups in the Mexico border is highest with men who have sex with men, male sex workers, commercial sex workers, female commercial sex workers, injection drug users, and pregnant women. And the proportion of Hispanics among total AIDS cases in San Diego County, as you can see, it's trailed off a little bit, but it's a very regional phenomenon that we see concentrations closer to the border region, of course, where we have larger Latino populations. And one of the things that we see across the board among Latinos in the United States is a shorter time period between diagnosis, living with HIV, and AIDS diagnosis. In San Diego County, we can see that for Latino Hispanics, the time between the HIV diagnosis and AIDS diagnosis within, or 1 year, less than 1 year, is higher for Latinos in San Diego County. And that really is what draws us into the asking why, and working with our colleagues in the Department of Health Services and locally, at the state level and locally, to understand which are some of the reasons, or what are some of the reasons that are driving this waiting so long after to get tested, and then perhaps fearing to get tested. And this is where we start to get into some of the issues of stigma. Yeah, please.
Okay. I don't know how to go back.
Oh.
I just wanted to mention that this is at the core of what I've been kind of trying to understand for the last 10 years working in HIV and serving primarily Latinos living with HIV. 90% of our HIV patients are Latinos. So it's a very homogeneous population that we're serving at San Isidro Health Center. And what I keep seeing is one is that the number of people diagnosed has been increasing since I started. There was maybe 4 to 5 on average a month that we were diagnosing, and it's up to 8 a month that we're diagnosing. We've diagnosed about 13 or 14 has been our highest number just in 1 month through our testing. And so we're not seeing things drop, we're not seeing things stay stable. It's a dramatic increase. And I've also had an opportunity during big events like National HIV Testing Day and AIDS Awareness Month to do some outreach with our community and talk to them about, do some questionnaires, talk to them one-on-one about getting tested and encouraging them to get tested. And I was very shocked. It's one thing to hear that Latinos are getting tested later. It's another to have a conversation about why they don't want to get tested and kind of analyze the data and analyze the conversation and put both together. People just are afraid to know, and they'd rather not know and extend that period of time of not knowing. For some reason, that makes sense to them because the fear is just too much. The fear and the stigma, as we're going to go into, is just too much. It's greater than the need to know and take action. And so that's a critical difference that I see in our community versus other communities. I had an opportunity a couple of years ago to go to New Orleans and do some HIV work there. And again, I had an opportunity during one of the events to do some outreach. We had a mobile unit. We were doing testing, and it was in the African American community next to a church. Never in my life have I done HIV testing or offered HIV services in a church-organized event, but that was a very interesting experience. And starting the event with prayer, and again, that's very interesting. My struggles here are to get the church to get involved, and over there it was just church first, and then we go into our event. So in promoting HIV testing among this population, I put on my outreach hat like I had done in the past with the Latino population, and it was just, I was shocked at the difference. I prepared myself to encourage and try to bring people into testing, and it took 2 seconds versus 10 minutes talking to an African-American man or woman versus a Latino. And that to me was very unique. I was prepared to have a whole conversation about why you should get tested and the mobile unit is here, and they would just say, okay, where do I sign up? And it was a shock to me. So I really saw the differences. It really dawned on me the differences in the different populations and how the approaches need to be different. The barriers are different, the issues are different, the cultures are different, and the approaches need to be different.
Excellent. Thank you. So that brought us to trying to understand a little bit more the role of stigmatization in HIV. And HIV stigma in particular, stigma is not, of course, unique to HIV. There are several highly stigmatized diseases throughout history. Leprosy is an example. Modern-day tuberculosis. So this is not the only stigmatizing disease. However, it's complicated as a stigmatized disease because many of the populations that are affected or living with HIV already feel stigmatized before being infected. And so this is one of the understanding that there are layers of stigmatization in this in persons living with HIV, or to understand the testing dynamics. Those are some of the things that we're working together to understand to break those barriers. So it's a complex concept that's based on prejudice or fear of prejudice, exclusion or fear of exclusion. Again, some of these are not necessarily areas that have been, that the person has experienced firsthand, but they're concerned or they're afraid, and they will respond, their behaviors may go in accordance with that. So it's discrediting or discrimination aimed at people living with HIV or who may be considered infected with by HIV, and as well discrimination of friends, partners. Many women we've spoken with are afraid that their children will be discriminated against by virtue of their living with HIV. This particular photograph was from our Mexico World Conference this year, and it was part of a select number of posters that really tries to show the impact of stigma and discrimination. Oh yes, sorry.
It's very interesting to see that this comes from the conference in Mexico. You're going to get to hear the next presenter will talk about a Promotores program that one of the sites of San Isidro Health Center. And we have about 10 to 14 promotores that are doing presentations in the community and talk about HIV/AIDS and talk about stigma. And I've seen the presentation, and I've seen how, again, these are a group of monolingual Latinos presenting to their own community. I've seen how difficult it is to understand the concept of stigma. We may understand it and have the differences, the list of what stigma is, but for them as Latinos and monolingual, more part of another culture, stigma is an alien concept that is hard to grasp, and they see it as it relates only to discrimination. And that's why it's very interesting to see that this poster or this picture is related to stigma, and it only has discrimination. They equate stigma to discrimination and discrimination only, and it's the subtleties of stigma are not conceptualized in their presentations, because they're so subtle that it's hard for them to grasp that is stigma. And so it's been very interesting to see how challenging it is to understand a concept that we seem to know acts as a tremendous barrier to care.
I think this is a... Go ahead.
The next slide.
That's all right. This is a particularly important point that Rosana is bringing up, because if it weren't for our joint work and community-based participatory research, we wouldn't be sensitive to understanding that we can't use the word stigma when we're doing interviews or when we have a questionnaire unless we qualify it. So in two different occasions, I've worked in qualitative research with populations that are served by San Isidro Health Center and University of California, San Diego. And one was a women's focus group and another was a men's focus group. And both times we had somebody who was comfortable enough, imagine if they're not comfortable enough, to say, ¿Qué es el estigma? ¿Qué quiere decir con eso? What is stigma? What do you mean by that? And so in that context, I allowed one of the other participants to define it for them. And so the participant said, la discriminación, ah, sí. So immediately that understanding of, okay, these are circumstances, this is what it really means to the participants. And so as much as we can get ourselves closer to, yes, they've experienced it in different ways, and not just as a person living with HIV. It may be as a person who is undocumented, or a person who is documented who's afraid of being deported because they're living with HIV. So these are things that allow us to express stigma in a way that's meaningful and relevant to persons living with HIV in our border region. So I'll let Rosana talk a little bit about this, the health model.
Well, this is the model that our HIV services is based on. We developed this model back when we received the HRSA SPINS grant, and we tried to identify the barriers that our patients faced at the time, and to For the most part, they currently are the same barriers. Communication, again, mostly Spanish-speaking population. Culture acts as a barrier as well with our population. Stigma, of course, we've been talking about that. Transportation was a huge barrier in the past. It's less now, but it continues to be a barrier, especially for women. So we identified first the barriers, and then we tried to link people to services through having community-level testing and outreach services down in the green circle, and link people to services through case management. I'm not sure if you're working in HIV, what population you're serving, but case management for Latinos is an essential service, because they kind of latch on to this person that they trust and get to know well, and that's a really important thing for Latinos, to trust someone and to discuss something very personal with someone you trust. And so case management became a key service that enabled us to connect people to care. And so the list of services that we have on the right were the services that we had at the time, and again, for the most part, we continue to have these services, but the list of services has grown. So this is the model. It can be applied. The same model can be applied to any population. It's just addressing the different barriers that the populations may have, and addressing the services that they may need, appropriate culturally and linguistically appropriate services that they may need to actually enroll and stay in care.
So as a result of this particular study, we started to understand a little bit more about stigma, HIV-related stigma, and barriers to care at the border. Previously reported to us, patients living with HIV have reported stress and anxiety when they cross the border, and some of it is linked to either having their medications with them or living with HIV in general. And persons who are undocumented, some Latinos fear being deported if they use public transportation. So in the context of understanding clinical trials, access, and some of the barriers to participating in care, we were able to really appreciate the notion that transportation in and of itself may not be the barrier, but the concern about being involved in what's called a redada, or if the Border Patrol is doing sweeps, as at one point they were doing on the trolley system. This was a concern to people who may be using public transportation to access services. So fear of deportation as well, if HIV status is disclosed to the Border Patrol, and concerns over crossing and having their antiretroviral medications. Part of the work that was funded by the HRSA project allowed us to look into a little bit more specifically some of the barriers to care. As we went into this particular component of analysis, we really were looking at what were the top barriers and what were some of the correlates of those barriers. And we were particularly interested in how border crossing and care utilization in the border played a role in this. So the population that we looked at, throughout the study, we recruited over 300 persons living with HIV/AIDS, and of course obtained voluntary and informed consent. We found that 157 of them had reported information on barriers to care and obstacles to getting medication and medical attention for their HIV. Among this population, 83% were of Mexican origin, and that is pretty much shows what you would see if you looked at Latinos living with HIV/AIDS in San Diego, in California as well. Men, mostly men, were recruited. The average age was 37. The range was from 19 to 67 years of age. About 39% were married or living cohabitating. And the majority of them, half of the population, were diagnosed as HIV positive one year prior to being enrolled into the study. 67.5% of participants crossed the border at least 5 times in the last year. And that really gives us some idea of the, and we actually had a very bimodal distribution. There were some participants that had not crossed within the last year. The question was phrased round-trip border crossings. The vast, the other large group of persons were more frequent border crossers. And this has actually presented, I like to bring this up in scientific meetings, a bit of a conundrum on how to measure border crossing. So we use reflection on the last 12 months and ask people, how many times have you crossed the border? For someone who's a frequent border crosser, let's say somebody who crosses like me, maybe a couple times a month, up to two times a week, to calculate that and extrapolate, it's a lot because I start to think, well, it's about this. So then I went to the other extreme and in another survey, in a different study, we asked, in the last month, how frequently did you cross? Well, this is a slam dunk question for people who cross frequently, but for people who cross maybe once a year, twice a year to get something and come back, it's not a realistic question. So we've kind of cut our losses a little bit and started to ask it as 6 months of time in terms of understanding frequency of border crossing. So some of the obstacles that we were able to look at in this particular population, the most frequently reported, and again, these were also, there's the publication I would reference if you would like more details on it, in multivariate logistic regression, where we looked at greater than or less, one or greater barriers to care or greater than one barrier to care or one barrier to care. So others will see me as negative in a negative light because I'm HIV positive. That was the primary reason that people who are currently in receiving services reported as a barrier to care. The medicines used for treating HIV can make me ill. 18.5% reported that. Concern that others might find out I'm HIV positive. Concern that my family could be opposed to my receiving treatment. 9.6%. Concern that others might think I'm gay or lesbian, problems crossing the border, and the medical attention is too expensive. So out of a list of approximately 15 questions, these were the top that were brought to our attention. And as we analyzed this a little bit closer, we started to realize that many of the barriers experienced by persons currently engaged in some level of services, in HIV services, those were HIV stigma-related questions and responses. So that was something that was that really got our attention in this particular study. And this is a poster of an anti-discrimination. It says, discrimination by HIV doesn't kill, but it takes life away. We've also done some qualitative work with these patient populations. And other ways that stigma is manifested, and I think that Rosanna described this so eloquently, is the patients, one of the patients told us, what happens if they see you somewhere where only infected people go? They'll know you've got it. And this is a translation from Spanish. So this is another concern. This is something that persons living with HIV, it's in their mind, it's present.
It just brought to mind a recent experience that I had with one of our patients. Again, I've been working in HIV for 10 years, and I try to respect the confidentiality as much as I am conscious of it. As far as our HIV positive patients, if I walk through the clinic, our HIV services are part of the overall services we provide at the clinic. So HIV patients and non-HIV patients are all sitting around in the waiting area, which is great because no one knows what they're there for. Stigma is as strong as, you know, minor things become bigger issues. I'll give you some examples of what I've seen and how stigma affects individuals. I hold a quarterly consumer advisory board meeting with about 10 to 12 consumers to just go over our services, what we're doing well to keep doing it well, what we need to improve on and get feedback. One of the comments that a female patient made was that the HIV staff had on their badges the red ribbon, and they felt very uncomfortable with that because they walked out and called out their name, and so the people around would see their red ribbon and know that they're going to go see the HIV provider. That's how basic it is. It's such an afterthought for us because, you know, the staff were like, but we're proud of wearing our ribbon. Yes, you're proud, but take it off because it's affecting care for our patients. And so that's one. The other one was, one of the things that I learned to do is to ignore everybody that's sitting in the waiting area. Even though, you know, some of them may approach me and say hi, and that's when I greet them, I try to not approach anyone because as soon as they see me talking to one of the patients, the staff around and others around will assume they're HIV patients. And so just my mere presence and my conversation with a patient, people just assume that they're HIV patients. So they would rather not say hi to me. So I avoid that by not making eye contact and walking through the clinic. And if they want to stop me and say hi, then that's when I do acknowledge that they're there. So all these minor things that become major issues for a person living with HIV. I went to the grocery store close to the office the other day, and this was very recent, and it kind of it was a firm reminder of how much stigma affects our population. I had issues with my card. It wouldn't go through, and so they called the manager, and the manager was one of our patients. And so as he's walking towards me, I smile and I say, hi, like, I know you, and he didn't respond back, he didn't smile back, and it was a quick one-second reaction on my part to just take a step back and say, oh, well, my card's not working, can you help me? And so he worked with me on the card, and we actually went to the side to figure what was going on, and we were alone by that time. He still didn't say hi, say anything to me that recognized that we knew each other. And this is a person I see on a weekly basis at an art group that he greets me with at the center. We say hi and with a hug. So it's not like if he's a stranger that I know he's a patient. He's actually someone I know very well. And so those are the minor things that become very major things in HIV care. That's the stigma. That's the stigma that they can't put their finger on because it's not discrimination right there. It's easy to relate stigma to discrimination because it's easier to see. But those minor examples become the examples that I use to highlight stigma and the impact stigma has on our patient population.
And I think that's a perfect segue into the next slide, where people feel that there's lack of information. What we've been talking about is a personalized stigma and how people really respond to how they think others may see them. And looking at how people perceive the community in general, in the Hispanic community, their total lack of understanding of AIDS is worse. They're scared that you might touch them or use their glass. And this was reported by a patient. Again, that's their perception, but again, they've in different family settings or social contexts, there is this awareness and this, actually it's not conscious, but there is this stigma attitude that patients feel. This is another poster of a campaign, an anti-discrimination, anti-stigma campaign in Mexico. These are words that have been spoken to others living with HIV. Eres una desgracia, you're a disgrace. Yo creía que no querías, I didn't think you wanted to. Es demasiado tarde para el tratamiento, it's too late to get treatment. So these are some of the messages that, these negative messages that can impact health access and health utilization. And so important to the mental health of persons living with HIV. So HIV-related stigma is what we've noticed is it's a barrier to care even for people after they've accessed care and are engaged in receiving services. And as Rosana has so eloquently pointed out, and I think there's more information or opportunities that we need to start to learn what tools can we work with and what can we provide? How can we increase resilience and decrease community-level stigma? And it's a long-term process. Again, HIV is not the only health the condition that is highly stigmatized. And again, you have some people living with HIV and tuberculosis, two highly stigmatized diseases. So it's a lot of work that we'd like to break down some of those barriers poco a poco. Some of the programmatic lessons learned, and I think what's going to tie us into the understanding of working, one of the challenges in working with breaking stigma barriers. Training and recruiting of staff for this particular study, the HRSA study, really needed to understand how to overcome stigma barriers. And within that, and I'll let Rosana talk a little bit about some of her experiences with it, in the Promotora model, we were working with some promotoras who had done diabetes outreach, they'd done cardiovascular disease health outreach, maybe infant immunization, but this was their first time, many of them, for working with HIV, and they were charged with going out and working with migrant workers and families to start to promote testing. And we were finding that for those promotoras for whom this was an initial experience, we weren't getting very many recruits of persons to test. And it wasn't until they had the confidence to come, as we had a community meeting with the promotoras, that we were able to understand they weren't as comfortable with the message. Yes, they practiced it, they rehearsed it, they were able to say the right words and to get consent from participants, but to really get to administer these questionnaires and to really talk about HIV prevention and testing, it was a challenge. And it was through modeling by other promotoras who were already seasoned outreach workers and HIV/AIDS that we started to break down in those barriers for the new promotoras. So I'll let you go ahead.
I think you described it very well. It wasn't a challenge that became obvious initially, that we weren't getting a lot of outreach surveys returned by this one clinic site. And it wasn't until we started probing that we realized that they weren't asking the sex-related questions, basically. And so it was because they were doing the outreach in their community, and so they felt uncomfortable asking. There's a sexual silence among Latinos that you just don't talk about sex. You do it, and you know there are consequences, but you don't talk about it within the family, much less with strangers. So your outreach workers, promotoras de salud, you're going out there and you're expecting me to talk about sex. Diabetes is fine. Any other health-related issue is fine, but anything related to sex, it was an issue. So again, we got them together in a room with seasoned outreach workers that have been doing HIV work for a number of years. So they exchanged strategies, how to do it effectively. And that worked, but it took a little bit of time to actually get at the core of what was going on. And it was the outcome was really great, and it was a visual outcome, because at the next meeting, we held monthly meetings. At the next meeting, this group brought in a stack of outreach surveys and put them on the table, like here. We were able to do these now from 1 month to the next, but it was only after acknowledging and receiving the training and, you know, learning to gain the confidence in how to approach a question. And mostly, if you know promotoras, they're mostly women, and they were doing mostly outreach to men. So again, those were the challenges that we had implementing this project.
Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Leticia Cáceres, who will be talking about her research with the promotoras and the populations that we serve.
Oh yeah. One thing I wanted to add is that Leticia didn't mention is that Leticia and I worked together for a number of years, and she doesn't. We can't seem to cut the umbilical cord between.